Midweek FA Cup replays? We're going to skip them. In fact, we're recording this show a day early. The next round of the Premier League is just that important. 1-3 at the Emirates, 2-4 at the Etihad. If the surprise stories leading the Premier League maintain their form, the carnage at the top of the world's most popular league will be cleared up come Sunday. Welcome everybody to the midweek edition of the World Soccer Talk Podcast. I'm your host, Richard Farley. Thank you very much for joining us. Round 26 of the Premier League season will be our focus in the second half of the show. But first, me and my co-host, Nipun Chopra, have come together to talk about the few things that have happened in the last 2 days since myself and Kartik Krishnayar were here on Sunday with the review show. And Nipun, let's start on Merseyside. Yeah. Everton is moving closer to, I guess, what we can call a long-awaited takeover. There's news that former San Diego Padres owner John Moores is inching toward a $290 million move to take over the club. So let's just start very generally. Good move, bad move? What's your feeling on this one?
Well, my first feeling is that Ken Wright gets a lot of criticism, and sometimes it's a little unfair. I think he's a good owner. And in fact, I just listened to an interview that was an interview with Martinez where he said as much. He said Ken Wright is a good owner, and I don't think he said in these words, but essentially what he was saying was if the takeover happens, it'll be because Ken Wright decides that these people are reliable, that they have the club's best interest at heart, because Ken Wright sure does.
Mm-hmm. I think I told you before I used to live in San Diego. You know that, right?
Yep.
You told me. I spent about 15 years in San Diego, and for most of the time I was there, I think maybe all the time I was there, John Moores was the owner of the Padres. He's a man whose riches come from the technology sector. He used to, I believe, be the CEO or the owner of Qualcomm. And one of the things that he did there, the Padres were always very economically stable, even though they were one of the smaller financial clubs in Major League Baseball, but he got the Padres into a downtown stadium in San Diego, worked the political system, got that built right in the middle of downtown, got them out of Qualcomm Stadium, which is the big NFL stadium. So obviously that has a parallel with Everton, who have this eyesore of Goodison Park that they're playing in. And if they can bring somebody in that has that kind of experience of going through that process, that would be something that really helps the club.
The stadium thing is interesting to me. This hits close to home for me. I know I'm comparing the NASL to Premier League Soccer, which is a ridiculous comparison, but the fact of the matter is we just had a recent issue where Peter Wilt, who was our GM, has moved on. Indy 11, correct. Not of Everton. I bet Peter would love to take over at Everton. I think he'd do a good job. He could do a good job anywhere. Mm-hmm. But point is that we've come to the point in world football now where the idea of getting someone in just for a stadium is a realistic thing. Mm-hmm. Because the issues with the stadium, You and I both have read extensively, I'm sure, on the economics of what stadiums bring. And
at least here in the United States, yeah.
At least in the United States, that's true. But at the same time, the source of pride for a stadium cannot be underestimated for loyal fan base. I know it's gone good. There have been good examples of it and bad examples of it, like moving from Highbury to Emirates and everything that entails. But I think that your idea about the stadium and how well Moore's got the stadium deal done for the Padres is a good one. Now, I guess let me ask you this. Is that one area, that parameter of getting a new stadium enough to generate interest enough to get this new management? Or do you think, and this is what I think, that management has to be, the ownership has to be thinking more in terms of what they will do with the team, what they will do with the manager, what their goals are they going to stay in the top four, and that sort of thing.
I wonder if Everton, you can even separate it out like that, because Goodison has gotten to a place where the revenue flows of Everton are so hampered by not having even an antiquated stadium. We talk about modern stadiums, right, where you have like Arsenal, who had to invest so many of the club resources to build this venue.
So long, yeah.
Yeah, but now obviously it's a major revenue generator, probably to some people's disdain that is generating a lot of ticket revenue the way that they do. Everton seems to be three or four generations behind that. And so they're at the point where they're significantly hamstrung. The prestige that the club has as one of the, one of the six or seven most successful clubs in English football history, it's totally constrained by their lack of actual capital resources. So I wonder if you really can separate the two. I wonder if it is so important that a new venue gets done in order for them to continue competing in the Premier League that that they have to do this.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. It will be interesting. It'll be another set of American owners. you pointed out to me that I thought it would be the sixth, but the point of so we have Kroenke, who is a part owner of Arsenal, but he is of course the majority owner. Mm-hmm. Lerner at Villa, John Henry LFC, Glazers at United, Ellis Short at Sunderland. So this will
John
be
John Henry at Liverpool.
Yeah, did I say that? I think I did. So in general, you have to wonder if this is a sign. I guess let me ask you: is this a sign that these owners realize the growth of the sport in America, or are they just investing because they know it's going to be generating revenue for them independent of the growth of the sport in America?
I don't think people are specifically seeking out American owners. Mm-hmm. I think that the value of these clubs in the Premier League has gotten to the point, and potentially the needs of some of these clubs, as the Crystal Palace example highlights, right, where they really brought in new American investors to help refurbish Selhurst. It's gotten to the point where you're looking for foreign ownership in general. There are a lot of other foreign owners in the league beyond the American owners. And when you're talking about different places on earth that not only have the cultural links, but the financial power to buy into a Premier League team, it's not that coincidental that Americans are buying teams. Americans are more predisposed to invest in English companies and English teams. America has a huge and deep sporting culture, and Americans have money. So
that's it. Yeah.
You line up those things together. And of course, we see foreign ownership all over the Premier League now. In fact, foreign owners vastly outnumber the domestic ones in the league at this point. So I don't know. I mean, I think David Kahn makes some good points about this by kind of wondering what it is about the Premier League that draws in Americans, and is the draw of Americans into the Premier League kind of leading to that franchisation of these clubs? But if it wasn't Americans, that's going to happen anyway, because most places in the world, whether it be North America or Asia or someplace else, are going to come in and look at these clubs as a business. So this isn't just about America, I don't think.
Yeah, good point. Another thing that happened, Richard, news story today, was that Sergio Busquets, who's one of my favorite players, says that Guardiola is one of those people that could entice him to go somewhere else other than his wife.
You've got
to
be hating this. You got all these players are going to be linked to City over the next 4 months. It's going to drive you crazy.
It's driving me crazy. That's exactly it. I was on ULF yesterday. I was talking about how, for me, Michael Carrick is the best, almost the best in the world in his position. The only person that I think is better than him, actually, is Busquets in that position.
That's a strong statement on Michael Carrick.
Yeah.
You are now really the biggest Michael Carrick fan on the show. You've passed Kartik Krishnaiyer.
Wow, that's saying something. Yeah, I love myself some Michael Carrick. I think he's a very underrated footballer. But the point being that Busquets, I mean, as you said, there will be lots of nonsense about the players that are linked, and Busquets probably will not end up at City because he has everything going for him at Barcelona. I'm sure they'll renegotiate his contract again and all that stuff. But the fact of the matter is that Guardiola has potentiated the drawing power of Man City, which was already considered.
Like it's a petri dish and we just added some solution to it.
Yeah, exactly. Potentiated.
I like it. Add a little bit of Guardiola here. All right, now we're predisposed for talent cultures to grow in this dish.
That's exactly right.
But it's true. Busquets is an interesting example because his ascendance into the first team of Barcelona coincided with Pep Guardiola taking over there.
Oh, absolutely.
And in that time, Barcelona has been the most prolific club in football history in terms of claiming trophies. So Busquets is, per a year that he's played, the most prolific football player in football history as far as team honors is concerned. So on one hand, you can ask, why would anybody leave Barcelona? They wouldn't leave Barcelona for competitive reasons, financial reasons. Even though Barcelona is winning everything, they're actually challenged every year in Spain. They're challenged in Champions League. It's not like they're rolling over people unless it's, you know, every other match day or something like that, or group stage of Champions League.
I was going to say, they roll over quite a few people.
They roll over quite a few people.
Valencia. Ask Valencia.
I can hear the voices in our listeners say, that's because Spain is so weak. Don't come at me with that. I'm the one person you do not want to come at with that. But Sergio Busquets might look at the other side of that coin and say, there is nothing left for me to accomplish here. In fact, I'm getting to the point in my career where I'm going to start asking questions. If I don't move away from Barcelona, I will always say, what if I did move? And now there's the most popular league in the world with the one coach that I would love to play with more than anybody else. Manchester City can pay wages beyond almost anybody else, and they're ready to compete for titles on all fronts. If I'm not going to make this move now, am I ever going to leave Barcelona? So I kind of think it might happen.
I mean, I see that logic. I guess the part of me that wants him to stay and not go to City is just really loud right now, just because I don't want to see him in City's blue. But the reasons you have laid out are fair. I think this thing that we say about players seeking a new challenge is a little bit overblown, though. Mm-hmm. I think it's like a football manager thing that you have coming out and saying, you know, I need a new challenge. I think someone like Busquets, who came through that academy, Piqué, Messi, Iniesta, Xavi, are happy to play out their careers at Barcelona because of the fact that they don't need a new challenge. They probably do, but the truth is that there's families involved and there's all of that off-field stuff involved there too. I mean, think about Lou moving from Barcelona to Manchester.
No, that's a very good point. I mean, you mentioned Xavi, and he obviously did eventually move to Qatar, but that was at the very end of his career, and there were other reasons involved that. Iniesta, if he does leave Barcelona, it'll probably be a very similar move. It'll be like 4 or 5 years from now. You also look at somebody like Carlos Puyol, who retired there as an icon. And all three of those players are an icon. I think the question is Sergio Busquets a similar level icon there? I think Gerard Piqué will grow into that if he's not already becoming that. But then again, he already had experience away from the club.
United,
and Busquets, Busquets hasn't had that. So for all these reasons, I think it's a very interesting situation. And Nipun is just one of a number of names we're going to hear linked to that club. We're already, of course, hearing names like Thiago Alcantara being linked to that. And I'm sure there'll be a couple of other Bayern players. And I'm sure just like few saw Thiago going from Barcelona to Bayern when Pep moved there, there's going to be one or two players that end up at City that we don't know. Like maybe Arturo Vidal's trouble settling in at Bayern will leave him to City. Or maybe somebody like Kingsley Coman, who's only on a loan right now from Juventus, ends up in England next year instead of being at Bayern. Who knows?
And Vidal has been linked to both Manchester clubs and to Chelsea for a couple of summers now, so that's actually a good shout.
Yeah, looking back on it, I'm kind of surprised he didn't end up at United. But then again, he was kind of like that Wesley Schneider, where it always seemed like it was right on the verge of it. Let's move on to one other story in the Premier League. This one's kind of interesting. It's interesting because it's kind of sad because Kurt Zouma was getting his first team time of his career with Chelsea, but this weekend suffered a knee injury. People feared the worst from the moment it happened, and then the worst news came this week. Torn ACL, out for 6 months. This is just, before we talk about like the implications on Gus Hiddink's team, this is just sad because Chelsea fans have been wanting players to come through and get real time. And Kurt Zouma had basically won that starting position over Gary Cahill over the last few months. And his development over the next, between now and May, was going to be key to Chelsea maybe being a, not so much a title contender next year, but charging towards the top four. How many people are they going to have to buy? If Zouma can establish himself there, maybe they don't have to spend the 30, 40 million in transfer fees to get somebody in central defense. Now, we don't know about that development, and given it's an ACL tear, we don't know what he's going to be like when he comes back.
Yeah, not only physically, Richard, but I think there's mental scarring from an injury like that where you're in that much pain in front of hundreds of millions of people. So there's that he'll have to deal with. And let's not forget that he's going to miss out, as you said, about in terms of development, he's going to miss out on a few months of playing alongside one of the best Premier League defenders of of all time, I guess, Premier League defender, is in John Terry. Because I think the education he was getting playing alongside John Terry, who is an incredible defender, was, you know, one of the most important things that he would have experienced. Now, with Terry, I guess.
He's going to be there next year. He's going to be their manager. You didn't hear that? I'm going to start that rumor. John Terry is going to be Chelsea's next manager. I mean, we're hearing a lot of rumors of Max Allegri coming in from Juventus to take over next year. I believe on last week's midweek show, you hypothesized the idea of Manuel Pellegrini. You're not the only person to hypothesize that either. Manuel Pellegrini moving to Chelsea. No. We've always known that John Terry was going to eventually be the manager of Chelsea. It starts in June.
It's Drogba, baby. Drogba's going
to
be
Chelsea and Drogba. That's it. I would love that to happen. But let's talk about on the field next to John Terry. Obviously, for Chelsea, this is I don't want to say it's a huge setback, but it does present a depth issue. Gary
Cahill, especially for the very warm relegation battle that's going on.
Yeah, I don't know if Chelsea's going to drift in there, but they now have like a smaller margin for error, right? I mean, Terry and Cahill are established. They obviously have their faults. There's a reason why Zuma was playing so much.
Right.
It's not that Cahill is bad. It's the combination of Terry and Cahill are a little bit too much alike for like. It's like that Otamendi Demichelis problem that we talked about this weekend, where neither of them are good one-on-one defenders. Terry and Cahill together just have no foot speed. And the next choice in line is Branislav Ivanovic, which doesn't help that problem either. So what are their
probably
options?
Probably makes it worse, actually.
Yeah, probably, even though he's playing at fullback where you would think speed's important. Yeah. But what other options do you see in the Chelsea fold right now?
So the big one that I'm sure we'll talk about in Miazga, we'll get into that. The other option...
I've never heard of this guy.
Miazga, he's this. He's an Indian defender that was brought over from the Indian Super League.
That'd be awesome if that were the case.
It would be awesome. Miazga, if you're listening, feel free to convert to the Indian to Indian citizenship. I will pay for it.
Oh, he could probably play striker for the Indian national team.
He could play anywhere for the Indian national team. Okay, so the other options are... Ola and Aina, you were talking about people coming through. Now, this is a young man who's represented Chelsea at every level from U11s up. Does not have any first team experience on the other. However, he was involved with the preseason, so he's been in and around the squad all year, Richard. So that's an option. Mm-hmm. The less likely option, even less likely option, is Baba Rahman. Now, Baba Rahman is someone who's played fullback, has made a few appearances. He has played as center back a couple of games for Augsburg, but in general, he's a fullback. So realistically, if you put aside Terry Cahill and Ivanovic, and let's not forget that all of those guys are, well, maybe not Ivanovic, but Terry and Cahill are probably unlikely to go through the season without getting at least one minor injury, which means Miazga is probably going to make his debut for Chelsea now.
And if he was still there, Nathan Ake would probably be getting a lot of time, or he'd be in line for a lot of time. Maybe once Chelsea fully is three or four games clear of relegation, if that ever happens, they would start playing some of these kids more. And not that Nathan Ake hasn't been getting a lot of time where he's at right now, out on loan this year, but it would be good for Chelsea to have some of those players that they've sent out this year in the squad. So now that they're in this kind of transition phase, they could see what those players are like. Some more news around the Premier League. Still the escalation going on at Anfield regarding the walkout this weekend, the 77th minute protest, the new ticket package that LFC is trying to put in for next year. A lot of support, including support from the FSF Supporters Union in England, trying to rally more supporters around that cause. Football League striked again. They leaked David De Gea's potential contract with Real Madrid. If Real Madrid's fax machine hadn't have broken, he would have been making $13.3 million a year. Wow. And then also sent around Manchester United, not really worth talking about, but The Sun had a report this week about Mauricio Pochettino's representation talking to the higher-ups about Manchester United regarding taking over this summer. I do want to get your thoughts on that, Nipun. It just seems like a very unlikely move, although kind of a great move for United. I just don't see Pochettino doing it.
Great move for United, a poor move for Pochettino. I think Pochettino, actually, when you, the three of us, you, Karthik, and I did the we rated the managers, we all rated Pochettino fairly highly. That's how, you know, we think he's a terrific manager.
Yeah, we had him at number five, right outside of that top four that we had established.
Yeah, yeah. And I think one of us had him as high as two or three. One of us did. Not me. I'm not that smart. But Pochettino, I think, is a very good manager. He had a good stint at Espanyol. Of course, we know his stint at Southampton, and now he has Spurs up in the Champions League spots and second currently. But the way what he's built at Spurs, I think it would be silly for him to let go of that. Yeah. Now, let me post this to you, though. If this summer Spurs loses a couple of players, and I'm thinking specifically in terms of Kane, Eriksen, or Dele Alli, if you're Pochettino, you start wondering if you will be able to achieve the kinds of goals that you are that you want to achieve. In that case, that might become an attractive option for him. Other than that, I don't see him moving. Your thoughts?
I agree with you. I think if this squad stays together, I can't picture another team being title favorites next year over Spurs. Now, there are a lot of moves that are going to happen. Money is going to be spent, but the money that's going to be spent by most teams is just going to be kind of like for like swaps. It's going to be Manchester United trying to bring in a wide player that they expected to perform the way Memphis Depay was expected to perform this year. Mm-hmm. I think Mauricio Pochettino's team, if it stays together, will be the title favorites going into next year. Now, to your hypothetical, those three players, I don't see Harry Kane moving because the type of teams that can afford him have superior strikers, and his price is going to be high.
Man United, dude. I would say the one immediately I think of is Man United.
I don't think there's any way Spurs sell Harry Kane to Manchester United. Manchester United, maybe Manchester United can pay some ridiculous fee that Spurs are like, oh my God, well, Harry Kane is not a £60 million player. We're going to take this.
Oh, of course not. Well, the thing is, we know that Spurs get every team to overpay for their talent. That's just a given.
So I think Manchester United, rather than doing that, would spend that money on players from around the continent because they do have that kind of draw. Dele Alli, I think that would be hard to even put a price tag on him given where he is at his contract cycle, just signing a new deal. But Christian Eriksen is the one person that you look at teams on the continent that can afford to spend $40 or $50 million for a player where you go, well, maybe Real Madrid would go out and get him, or maybe something at Bayern Munich would work out there too, even though Bayern doesn't typically spend that much. I think Spurs, though, are in this nice situation where they don't have a Bale or Modric level player, and they have the financial clout to stave off any attempts for players kind of below that threshold. So I find it very difficult to think that very many players are going to move on from Spurs this year. I mean, what do you think?
Yeah, that's a good way to phrase to put it, Richard. What I'll say is that there are players in that team that I think vultures, and in some ways, that's what my beloved United and Real Madrid and Barcelona are in terms of attracting players, especially from Spurs in the case of Madrid and United. But when you look at someone like Lloris or Tongan,
or even somebody coming in and paying like $24 million for Dembele.
Right. I was going to say Dembele would be the next one. There are players that can be taken away from the Spurs team, and it will be, I guess, that we'll find out about Pochettino's managerial ability, how he replaces this perfectly tuned machine he has right now in Spurs. If any of those players leave.
What a crazy year that we are about two-thirds of the way through the season, and we're talking about next year's title favorites being Tottenham Hotspur. What a crazy time in English football. When we come back from this break, we're going to talk about the bottom three in this year's league, our predictions for where we think that's going to end up with the knowledge we have right now, and then we're going to start counting down the 10 matches this weekend in the 26th round of the English Premier League season. Stay with us. This is the World Soccer Talk Podcast. All right, Nipun, let's talk about the relegation battle. A relegation battle that's getting more intense now that we've got some life out of Aston Villa. 8 points in their last 5 games. Yeah. Not exactly within touch of 17th place, but it's not so hard to imagine them getting there if they continue this run. But let's talk about our bottom threes. Given what we know now, what three clubs do we think are going down?
Yeah, my bottom three hasn't changed from the first day of the season. It's still exactly the same. Aston Villa, Sunderland, Norwich City. For me, Villa, even though they have had a couple of good results, and some of it has come after the moment that we actually thought Jamie Vardy was walking away from the club, which is interesting. Yeah. And Sunderland, just not enough quality there. Now we know Defoe is injured for a couple of games, possibly. Mm. That's going to hurt them. And Norwich City, as I had said when I recorded with Karthik, there was a false dawn there with Mbokani. I thought he would give them a couple of goals and give maybe catapult them to 17th place. But since that Liverpool game where he was terrific, he has done absolutely nothing.
Yeah, Norwich City is the worst team in the league right now, the way they're performing. So since they're in the bottom three, it's very difficult to pick them to survive unless you find some reason that they're going to turn around. And given how they're playing, they're definitely in my bottom three. Aston Villa, too. I think just the math of it makes it difficult to pick them, even though they're probably not one of the three worst teams in the league at this very moment. So the one debate I end up with is Sunderland versus who? And based on the teams that are above the drop, the ones immediately above the drop being Swansea and Newcastle, I don't think Sunderland's going to outplay them. I just wonder if West Brom is going to end up falling all the way back to the pack. And I think West Brom right now has 9 points on Sunderland. It's just not enough time, I think, given how the teams are playing now. So my bottom three is the same as yours, but I do, you know, if I were a Baggy supporter, I would be really worried that one of these other teams gets hot along the way. Nipun, 10 games this weekend. We're going to count them down from 10 to 1, starting with what we think is the least interesting at number 10, Crystal Palace versus Watford. It's Saturday, 10 o'clock Eastern time start. I think these are two very good teams, Nipun, but they're just not two very good teams that match up together are going to put together a great game of soccer. Expect just a few goals. This is going to be a tight one. I don't know who's going to decide it or what's going to decide it. I just don't suspect this is going to be a very entertaining game.
Definitely not. I think Palace's issue is putting the ball in the net. They create enough chances, in my opinion, just not a no striker there. So probably a 0-0 is probably a good guess there. Number nine is Norwich City versus West Ham. West Ham are winless at Carrow Road in the last 16 Premier League matches between the two. It's a pretty crazy stat there. West Ham will be fatigued after their win today, Richard. They won a last-minute header, incredible header by Ogbonna.
Played a lot of regulars, too.
Yeah, played a lot of regulars. They will be exhausted, but they'll also be buoyed by that win, you know, because with Liverpool, if it went to PKs, Liverpool was probably going to go through. So there'll be the lift of that. Norwich City will be well-rested, but I give the edge to West Ham just based on some of the things we talked about Norwich City about a few minutes ago.
Number eight, Swansea City versus Southampton. Two informed teams. Swansea, particularly after Guadalupe came on to take over the head coaching responsibilities, has been very good, undefeated in their last four. Southampton, one of the better defenses in the league right now, if not the best. And that's probably why we have this one ranked so low. Southampton, yeah. If they score the first goal, they're going to lock down on this game and win this one. The only question, can they replace Vincent Wanyama? Red card last game, suspension. And since it's in Wales, you got to think that Swansea has a little better chance than you might otherwise expect.
Yeah, I would give Swansea the edge if Ki Sung-yong were fit, but I still think he has that concussion issue. So I think he's so important to that Swansea system that I give the edge to Southampton, even though they're missing Wanyama in this game. Next one, we have number seven, Richard, is Bournemouth versus Stoke City. As you were right about all along, you evil bastard, Stoke City is just hemorrhaging points, is playing poorly, is not very pretty to watch. There is no Stoke Alona, you were right, all along. On the other hand, Bournemouth, in my opinion, have come. They lost the last game, but I think with Afobe up top, with the Iturbe coming in, they have done enough, and I actually pick Bournemouth to have the beating of Stoke City in this game.
Yeah, Bournemouth played okay this weekend, even though they lost 2-0 to Arsenal, giving up two goals in basically 2 minutes in the first half. I think aesthetically, this is going to be a very good game. These are two teams that like to keep the ball on the ground. I'm just not sure that there's very many. The stakes are very high in this one. Bournemouth could be pulled back into a relegation battle. I'm not convinced they will be. Stoke is now starting to get mired mid-table and looking like they're going to have a lot of insignificant games over the next 4 months. I'm not sure what the stakes are in this game.
Stop gloating.
Now, the stakes in the next game are number six on the list are pretty clear. Aston Villa is hosting Liverpool. Liverpool still has Europa League aspirations. Their league form is making it harder to justify those. But Aston Villa, of course, like we said at the beginning of the segment, 8 points in the last five games, actually getting results now at home against the Liverpool team, where a couple of regulars did appear in today's game. Felipe Coutinho actually started this one, so you wonder if he's going to start this game on Sunday, even though there is a big turnaround. This looks like an opportunity for Villa to continue their good form against a very inconsistent Liverpool. I wouldn't put money on any result. I'm not going to be surprised by any result.
Liverpool today didn't play Sakho and Toure, who will probably come in as center backs. Sturridge played today, Richard. He had good 20, 30 minutes where he had a few good moments. Benteke missed a few sitters. So there'll be massive rotation. And because of the fact that Sturridge is back and Coutinho is back, I'm going to give the edge to Liverpool in this game. Number five, Richard, is Everton versus West Brom. Everton continue to impress me, especially in the last few games. They have started to really turn the gears a little bit. I think they're heavy favorites in this game, in my opinion. West Brom has Johnny Evans missing. He's still injured. So Everton, even though West Brom will set up in what is essentially a goalkeeper and 10-0 formation, Everton will have enough attacking prowess to get past them.
Yeah, what a difference in styles here. Everton, all goals, no defense so far this year, very little defense. West Brom, all defense, no goals this year. The difference is Everton's starting to put things together. They actually haven't been conceding very many goals lately. Part of that is because the fixture list has been kind to them, but the fixture list is kind to them on Saturday. West Brom is not going to threaten them. West Brom is probably going to do their best to make arguably the most exciting team in the league not exciting, but it's a good Sin Park. Every indication here is that these are teams going in different directions. Everton is the team that's climbing the table.
John Stones and Howard, I think, are still missing for this game. So that's something I guess West Brom will look at in terms of areas. If they ever get forward, maybe that's something.
Yeah, I'm not sure very many Toffee supporters are going to be sad about those absences either.
Yep, that's true.
Number four on the list, Chelsea versus Newcastle, a game that doesn't have a ton of significance, although both of these teams are trying to inch their way above the relegation zone, something that's a little bit more important right now for Newcastle than Chelsea, yeah, who appear to be safe. But this match has given us a lot of good fixtures in recent years. Newcastle a little bit more prone to spring upsets on Chelsea, catching them on the counter. We've seen some very clever plans put in place by Alan Pardew in the past in this match. It just, when these two teams get together, it rarely is boring. Both teams have talent, even though they haven't had results this year. And this should be a good one. This is the 12:30 Eastern time start on Saturday. It should be a decent product for that isolated time slot.
Do you have a favorite Chelsea versus Newcastle moment?
I'm not sure.
For me, I think, unless I'm remembering this incorrectly, Richard, I think Papiss Cissé scored that incredible goal against Newcastle game, right?
Yeah,
I think that was Chelsea Newcastle.
That's how my memory is too.
I think they won 2-0 that day. If I'm remembering correctly, and our listeners can
that seems right. That seems like one of the games where Newcastle had no business winning it, yeah, but then a goal like that, I think I remember some of my Chelsea friends just kind of going, "What were we supposed to do? We can't stop that goal."
Literally cannot do anything about that.
Yeah, no, that was an absolute great goal. What about this match? What are you feeling about this one?
I think Chelsea have looked better. I think they in the game against United, you guys talked about it. I think they were better. They played better. United was the better team. But for me, Newcastle is actually a little bit of a favorite in this game, mostly because I don't see with the injury we talked about in defense, I don't know if Terry and Cahill are going to be able to handle the likes of Wijnaldum. I know Wijnaldum has kind of fallen away a little bit, and Mitrovic.
Or if McLaren really goes after that speed factor and starts Perez up top instead of Mitrovic.
Yep, that's also a good point. So Perez has done well as a sub too, you know. So
yeah,
even if Mitrovic starts, I can see it going either way, Mitrovic coming off the bench. So in that sense, I'll give the slight edge to Newcastle.
A lot of options there. Let's go to the number three match on the list, Sunderland versus Manchester United. By the table, this looks like there isn't much balance here, but Sunderland has actually been playing better lately. We saw them give City troubles in the last game at the Stadium of Light.
They deserve to win at City, for sure.
We saw them come back against Liverpool last week and taking advantage of a lack of focus at the end. Manchester United has also been playing better football lately, even though the results haven't quite been there. Put those things together, and this looks like an interesting game.
I think it will be an interesting game. I don't think this was a game that would be earmarked by a lot of people, but I think you make some good points there. For Sunderland, as I mentioned, Defoe is injured, which is a problem. Borini is still injured. Larsson, long-term injury. So the goals issue will continue for them. Van Aanholt is still their most creative player. In my opinion, with United playing better, with Martial playing probably the best football he's played this season, which is saying a lot because he's been our Manchester United's best player. With Rooney coming back to form, with Lingard having scored in the last game, the man of the match for me, other than De Gea, Richard, in the last game, was actually our left back, Borthwick Jackson. Even though he made that City mistake, I thought he was he had a very good performance crossing the ball from the left. So with those things, I'm going to say United are favorites for this game. I always say that on the podcast, and United drop points, but I'm going to stick to it.
Yeah, such a tough moment for Borthwick Jackson at the end, keeping Diego Costa onside and effectively costing his team 2 points. But like you said, I think that probably overshadowed a lot of good work going forward, some smart decisions in the final third, ability to make a difference actually as the ball approaches the other team's penalty area. For a Manchester United fan, a game where Lingard scores a goal and then Borthwick Jackson looks so good kind of keeps that club's tradition going. Let's talk about the two main matches this weekend.
Here we go.
All the top four matching up against each other. And what sticks out about these two games, and we're going to talk about Manchester City versus Tottenham first, is that the reverse fixtures earlier this season were not close. Manchester City visiting White Hart Lane earlier this year throttled 4-1, one of two embarrassing 4-1 defeats earlier this season. And then the second game, Arsenal versus Leicester City, Arsenal one of two teams to defeat the Foxes this year, and they won 5-2 at the King Power. So let's talk about the game at the Etihad. What are your feelings? What jumps out to you about this one?
What jumps out to me for the City game is that Vertonghen will be a miss. I know they've managed to go on without him, but Vertonghen against Aguero, I think, would have been a matchup that you would actually put a little bit of money on Vertonghen. Without him, I think Aguero will, even with Alderweireld, who's had a very good season, I think Aguero has the beating of him. So that's one thing that sticks out at me. And Richard, the other big thing, and I'm sure we were going to get into it, so I apologize for jumping ahead. But the big thing is, I did not realize how bad City had it in terms of injuries. Mm-hmm. They're missing Nasri, Navas, De Bruyne, and probably Silva, probably Kompany, and Mangala.
Right. That attacking midfield that looked like it was such a source of depth, so much so that people were wondering why they spent money on De Bruyne.
Why they spent all this money, yeah.
And I think compounding the depth issues is the fact that Manuel Pellegrini, even though Kaliche Iheanacho has stepped forward and looks like a Premier League caliber player, we saw last week that he's not really aggressively using him. He's still in his kind of big game formations, is only going with Aguero up top. So whereas somebody like Iheanacho could mitigate some of the issues of losing those attacking midfielders, he seems reticent to use him, and he seems more likely to rely on his central midfield depth to offset the numbers. And last week against Leicester, that kind of cost him the game from the get-go.
Yeah, I agree with that. But I think in this game, he will have to set that right. I think given the personnel that are missing in this game and what happened last week, he probably starts with Sterling, Iheanacho, Yaya, and Aguero, right, in the four up top. That would be my prediction.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I really don't know. The Silva thing really does throw things off a lot because there isn't another wide midfielder that's been regularly played this year. They brought in a youth product to make up the numbers this weekend, and he got on late against the Foxes. But it's hard to see him starting a game of this magnitude. So, yeah, I do think something like that, or maybe Delph plays just in wide midfield instead of kind of like that hybrid wide midfield role that we've seen him play a lot on the left side this year. But it's so trying, not only because they lost 4-1 in the other game they played against Spurs, but you talked about some of the matchup issues, or you alluded to them. They need to find a way to get the ball to Aguero. They need to find a way to isolate Aguero on Wimmer, 23-year-old that's stepping in for Vertonghen, and test them. And between players like Dembele and Dele Alli and Eriksen making it difficult to make that connection and the lack of quality, this game seems like it could get really bogged down for Manchester City.
Yeah, I don't know how what Pellegrini will be thinking from a tactical perspective, because he has been embarrassed just a week ago by Leicester City, and that was an embarrassment, nothing short of an embarrassment. So there is some serious pressure on Pellegrini at this moment, given that the Guardiola news came out a week ago, given they were embarrassed by Leicester City, to have a good performance in this game. Now, does that mean, Richard, he's going to sit back and he's going to set up in a way to ensure that City don't get embarrassed, that even if they have to eke out a draw, that's a good result?
Maybe at this point, with the limitations you're talking about, because we just think how the game might play out. You have that City defense that you mentioned is hamstrung. Maybe their two best central defenders, or at least two of their three best central defenders, unavailable against Spurs pressure. You've got that midfield that's looking very not dynamic lately. So even if Otamendi and Demichelis are able to move the ball forward, they're still going to have troubles matching up there. And last week we saw against a team that doesn't exert the same pressure as Spurs does, we saw Sergio Aguero just get lost. They couldn't connect to him. I don't think that's going to be any better. Now, if we're talking about a game that Spurs are going to dictate in that way because Manchester City's not able to make those connections to get the ball forward into attack, then Kane versus those center backs that have had so many troubles, winning their one-on-one battles becomes more important. Yaya Toure in the defensive phase, making sure he or Fernando can keep track of Christian Eriksen, that becomes more important. Does Eric Lamella have the one-on-one opportunity against Alexander Kolarov that you don't necessarily want him to have if you're a City fan? I think there are a lot of things here that when you start to play out the game in your mind look very bad for Manchester City, and particularly bad because, like we're talking about, there are not a lot of options for Pellegrini to be able to avoid these things.
Look, the thing for me, the big one is, again, I know this is oversimplistic, but again, Yaya Toure is so important to this game. Because if you play Yaya Toure in that deep holding role, this game is over. There's no way that City wins this game. The only way you can, just to finish this point, Yaya has to be played in the advanced role because he does not have the legs to track back. he will not win the battle against someone like Eriksen. So, you know, you have to play Fernando Fernandinho in those deep roles to keep Yaya Touré out of the defensive possession.
I think that's a good point, because last week it seemed like Pellegrini was trying to make this compromise where Yaya in the defensive phase would be one of the central midfielders. He'd be next to Fernandinho, and then Delph could split out to the left to help with Mahrez. But Yaya Touré, because of his lack of effort at this point, or maybe it's not lack of effort, maybe there's some kind of health issue or age issue, he wasn't able to make up the ground to get into the attack. So essentially Pellegrini sacrificed an attacker and didn't have a way to make up those numbers going forward. So now if he switches systems a little bit, maybe plays Touré farther forward so he doesn't have to make up the ground, he's just up there already, or maybe he plays like a straight 4-4-2 of some kind and just relies on Iheanacho and Aguero up top, and then maybe wide midfielders of Delph and Sterling to then play as kind of traditional wingers. Maybe that works. But either way, like you're mentioning, there has to be some kind of solution for Yaya Touré.
There has to be.
Yeah, I mean, just rely on him to be this very expansive midfielder to cover the ground that he used to, because to this point in the season, he's proving that he can't do that anymore.
That's exactly right. There was a time 3 years ago you could stick Yaya Touré anywhere on that pitch in the central position, whether it was holding, whether it was a traditional central midfielder, whether there was an attacking midfielder, and he would deliver for you any game against anyone in the world. That's how good he was. But it's just not realistic to expect his 33-year-old legs to track back for 90 minutes every game now. And Pellegrini has to make that decision, and he has to make it for the rest of the season, not just for this game.
Yeah, the more I think about it, now I'm starting to wonder if we might see Gael Clichy or Alexander Kolarov actually in midfield just to help with the situation.
Yeah,
so we're pretty pessimistic about City's chances here.
Yeah.
What gets really interesting, if Tottenham maintains their form, if Manchester City maintains their form, meaning Spurs leave the Etihad with 3 points, all of a sudden it's going to be City versus United for the fourth place.
Oh, I mean, look, even as a United supporter, I don't see a way back for United into this top four. I was talking about it on ULF yesterday. The most likely for me would be for Spurs to have a Spursy moment, and I just don't see it happening. So for me, the top four is pretty much how it's going to play out. And you know, the historic lovers of United, Liverpool, Chelsea just have to sit back and appreciate a crazy Premier League season.
I agree with you, but if Manchester City wins at the Stadium of Light and Manchester City loses, that gap is only 3 points. And it's not only 3 points. City have an anchor and Manchester City's floating up. Manchester United is floating up.
Yeah, but City still have more game changers than United. United still has a lot of long-term injuries. City will have a lot of these players coming back. I know De Bruyne is done. There's no doubt about that. But Silva and all these guys,
Kompany,
they will
and
be.
Mangala are getting close.
Yeah, whereas United's injuries are long-term, almost all of them. So the injury issue at United will not get better.
Okay. Let's switch focus. Third in the league versus first in the league in North London at the Emirates Stadium.
We didn't really talk about Spurs, by the way. We should maybe for a minute at least give them their formation or their, you know, personnel some credit here as well.
Oh, yeah. No, I think we did. I mean, we started talking about all the problems that they can present between the midfield pressure players like Dembele and Ali can help exert.
Exactly.
Eriksen being so dangerous that Touré's lack of effort is going to be a problem. And Harry Kane, if they can get Harry Kane into any one-on-one matchups against those central defenders, it's going to be problematic. And then Eric Lamela, too. I think Kolarov kind of gets a bad rap a lot of times, but Kolarov versus Lamela is not a matchup that Pellegrini is going to want. So we'll see how that plays out. But like you just hinted, Spurs have danger men everywhere. Yep. And even when we're talking about Aguero versus Wimmer, Eric Dier can cut that out. Eric Dier is one of the best defensive midfielders in the league this year. So he's going to be big in preventing that.
Because that's actually a really good shout, because the more Aguero gets isolated, the more he's going to drop into those positions where Dier becomes even more important. So Dier being in that position is very important.
Yeah, even saying that, there are kind of a lot of thoughts that jump into my mind, because that's where they're really going to miss David Silva, because when Aguero has to go wide to get the ball, if he goes to David Silva's side, Silva's ability to play and then run into those central forward positions where he can still be effective, Raheem Sterling's ability to fill that space too, that really allows Aguero to go into wide areas, be effective as a decision maker with the ball at his feet. So not having Silva to come up, fill those spaces, or be the person that can find him wide. Well, David Silva is just an important player. I guess we didn't need that many words to say that.
Last thought on this game, Richard. Mm-hmm. Watch Aguero get a hat trick and Yaya Touré have 3 assists.
Those players could go off at any time. I suppose that's the disclaimer we should have said 15 minutes ago. Let's talk about Arsenal versus Leicester City. I want to go back to the game at the King Power Stadium, which was 5-2. It was one of our early hints that Leicester City might fall back to the pack at some point, and in that way, that hint was a lie. But I think the question we have to ask about this matchup right now is, what reason is there to think Arsenal isn't still head-to-head, maybe not overall as far as league campaign is concerned, but head-to-head, what reason is there to think they're not going to be able to put up a similar result?
I think Sanchez is not in the kind of form he was back then. I think
Sanchez had a hat trick that day.
Yep. So I think that's a huge thing. I think Sanchez's drop in form has coincided with Arsenal fluctuating a little bit. They're still, by the way, still been my pick for winning the league, but I am cognizant of the fact that they haven't been performing as well as they were at the start of the season. Another issue for me is in the central midfield. At that time, they had Cazorla fit. Alongside him, they had Flamini. At that time, they had Arteta fit as well. So they had a lot of fit players that they could move around, move the puzzles around depending on the opposition. Right now, that's not the case. Cazorla is out. We'll talk about Flamini, I'm sure. Arteta is still out. Mm-hmm. Kokalin maybe comes into the picture in that holding role. So those are two big reasons I can think of that which convinced me that it will not be a blowout like it was.
Let's definitely talk about the midfield situation for Arsenal, because I think a lot of fans are going to be wondering if this is the time to push Francis Coquelin into the starting lineup since he's been healthy for a couple of weeks now, but he hasn't claimed that spot back yet from Matthew Flamini. But I think going back to the question that I posed to you, what has changed? Leicester's defense has played better. They've improved.
True. Very good point.
Back then, they were one of the worst defenses in the league, and the Foxes were having to outfox people on the run.
Well done.
Now, thank you. Now, Wes Morgan and Robert Huth have really tightened up. Kasper Schmeichel, probably one of the four or five best keepers in the league this year. His distribution has been really good.
Yeah.
My problem with their central defense is they're kind of playing with two traditional central defenders, sacrificing some speed for some strength, some size, and I think that's worked well for them. But the problem comes when you have Alexis Sanchez as somebody that come cut in from the left. When you have maybe Theo Walcott starting in the right, two very fast people. When you have somebody like Mesut Ozil who can drift into spaces, change the point of attack, allow those players to come up and take advantage of the space that Olivier Giroud creates with his movement and his runs. And so I think that becomes the challenge for Leicester. How do they prevent those connections to those guys that can outrun their slower central defenders?
Well, the big one then you have to consider in terms of those runs is the tracking of Conte, is the play of someone like Drinkwater, right? Those midfielders become extremely important in those battles. And the runs from deep are really the big asset that Arsenal has. I think Giroud is a good forward. There's no doubt about that. He's a good target man. But the reality is that most of the time when we've seen Arsenal score for these incredible goals, it's because someone from midfield is making a run that is not tracked, whether it's Ozil, whether it's Campbell, whether it's Oxlade-Chamberlain, whoever it is, Sanchez, of course, who we mentioned. So if those runs are tracked, I think, which Leicester has been doing a good job of lately, using Conte and Drinkwater, I think that's something that that Ranieri will be looking at tactically.
Yeah. If I were Wenger, what I would try to do is get Mesut Ozil on the ball in the wide areas behind Albrighton and Mahrez and force Simpson or Fuchs to come out and play him. Run Giroud into those spaces and force the center backs to split and then bring Ramsey forward, bring Sanchez or Walcott in from the flanks and then try to isolate the central defender and the fullback that are left in that space. Like you said, the runs coming from midfield, and that makes it even more important for Conte. What is his responsibility? Is he going to be the one that's going to have to follow Mesut Ozil? If that's the case, Danny Drinkwater, can't take yourself out of position because you have to be the person that picks up Aaron Ramsey coming from the midfield. If all that happens, how quickly then can Leicester spring on an Arsenal team that has committed Aaron Ramsey forward and now has Matthew Flamini trying to protect their central defenders? It's a matchup that I wouldn't necessarily like for them. I think also about Leicester, one of the things that I really love is that they like to play the ball quickly and directly. Yeah. And I love the matchup of putting ball into space to the right of Per Mertesacker, having Jamie Vardy claim that ball, and then having Mahrez come in from the other side and Okazaki come in and attacking the near post. I would love that play if I were Claudio Ranieri.
Absolutely. That run that Vardy makes that is in between the defenders or on the other side of the defender where Mahrez places the ball from 40 yards, 50 yards, whether it's on the, along the ground or over the top like we saw in the last game. That's the kind of run. And actually, now that you mention it, that's the exact goal that that Leicester scored against United, where Vardy broke the, I think it was 13 goals in 13 games. That was exactly the run that Vardy made. Mahrez played him in perfectly. Bang, goal. So that kind of run would be troubling for Mertesacker. If I am Wenger, however, I will still be showing Mahrez to the outside with the belief that, first of all, you don't want Mahrez to cut inside because he's unstoppable once he cuts inside. Mm-hmm. If you let Mahrez go on the outside and you sort of believe that any cross that comes in, whether it's targeted to Okazaki, Ochoa, or Vardy, the height of Mertesacker will be able to get any overhead crosses. The issue is the drag back, because if there's a drag back, Mertesacker doesn't have the leg speed to cut out any shot. So you need someone, one of your defensive midfielders or your holding midfielders, to track back to make sure that if someone like Okazaki has cut across from the other side for the drag back, that there is someone to block him. So those are things that Wenger should be looking at.
Yeah, I really like that too, because I don't think Arsenal needs Nacho Monreal getting forward to win this game. I think that they can rely on that flank staying open for Mesut Ozil to exploit, or getting the ball quick out there to Alexis Sanchez and giving him some chances to see if Danny Simpson is up to the task. I don't think they need Nacho Monreal to be effective on the attacking half of the field for them to win this game. And in that sense, he can kind of stay home and answer the what do we do with Mahrez problem. We saw City try to dedicate Fabian Delph to him. Didn't really work. Got burned in the third minute of that game, led to the first goal. This time, they can just keep their fullback at home. And in that way, though, it goes back to something that Kartik and I talked about this weekend, just the pure ability to win one-on-one battles. I like, as much as anybody, I like Nacho Monreal's chances to at least keep up with Mahrez as much as anybody could. Elsewhere, though, is Per Mertesacker, if he gets isolated with Jamie Vardy, is he any more likely to win that one-on-one battle? What midfielders are going to win that ball from N'Golo Kante that we didn't see City midfielders win last week that led to the second goal? When you go and look at these Leicester players that are consistently beating their man in one-on-one, get to the ball, 50-50 situations, who in Arsenal is more likely to win those battles than the players on City were last week?
I mean, this brings me to my biggest tactical issue with Arsenal, which is if they play a high line in this game, the game is over. Because for two reasons. One, we know the pace of Vardy. We know the work rate and pace of Okazaki. That's obvious. Mm-hmm. But the other thing is Arsenal have been pushing up a lot with Mertesacker, which works in some games. But if you want to beat Leicester City in this game, you have to have a lot of space because Leicester will be well organized. So the more you push up your front line, the less space your midfielders have to work. So as long as Mertesacker isn't... So if you're pushed up to the halfway line when you're in control of the ball, you are set up perfectly to get scored on by Leicester City. Mm. So in that sense, I think if Wenger, and Wenger's a brilliant, brilliant manager, I firmly believe that he will not make what I consider would be a rookie mistake, which is to play a high line against Leicester City.
Yeah. You know, you think about the goal, the first goal that City gave up, that great goal by Jamie Vardy, and you mentioned it earlier in the show, the pass that Riyad Mahrez had to play in order to put Vardy in that situation, against Liverpool, sorry, not against City, where Simo Mignolet was kind of caught off his line on that one.
Surprise.
One of the things there that relates to what you just said is the fact that Riyad Mahrez had to play that ball. Liverpool was a bit stretched, but they weren't at the point where they were so crammed up on the center line that somebody like a Christian Fuchs or a Danny Simpson could play that ball and make the connection. They had to connect through the midfield. Now, if that space in midfield gets so compact that a Christian Fuchs could play the ball instead of Leicester having to look for one or two passes before springing Jamie Vardy, well, that, like you just alluded to, that plays into Leicester's hands a bit. So yeah, I think that is a good point. How high will they play that line, particularly given just how utterly important Jamie Vardy is to not only how Leicester scores goals, but how they alleviate pressure too. How they
because that's, you know, that becomes the temptation, right, Richard? When you have 75-80% possession, which I'm sure Arsenal will have 60% possession in this game, your central defenders start feeling comfortable. They start pushing up. Suddenly they're at the halfway line, and then bang, counterattack goal. It's just how Leicester has operated so often in this game that surely Wenger will not fall for the sucker punch.
Well, Nipun, for a show that maybe is notoriously too nerdy sometimes, I think we maybe just had two of the nerdiest match analyses that we've ever had on a previous show. But I'm really excited about these games now. Manchester City versus Tottenham is the late game on Sunday. Arsenal versus Leicester is the early game on Sunday. Your picks for these games?
I'm going to go with Leicester in the Arsenal game, which is crazy because I think Arsenal will win the league. And I'm going to go with a draw in the City versus Spurs game.
Yeah.
You?
I can't believe I'm doing this, but I think after picking things apart, I'm definitely going with Spurs in the late game. I want to lean towards draw with Arsenal versus Leicester, but I can't believe I'm doing this. Leicester 2-1. Oh my God.
Yes.
That does not feel good. I reserve the right to change my mind. Check my Twitter account sometime between now and Sunday. But come Sunday, go to worldsoccertalk.com. Check World Soccer Talk's Twitter account because our review show will be there. Myself, Kartik Krishnaiyer, Lawrence McKenna, walking through the 26th round of action in the Premier League, arguably the most important weekend between now and the end of the season. But until then, for everybody at World Soccer Talk, I'm Richard Farley. Nipun?
Enjoy your futsal.
The World Soccer Talk podcast is a production of World Soccer Talk and is executive produced by Christopher Harris and produced by Richard Farley. You can get the podcast a number of different ways, including Stitcher, iTunes, TuneIn, SoundCloud, and Audioboom, or you can go to worldsoccertalk.com to download the show directly. To get in touch with one of the hosts, you can reach out to them on Twitter. I'm Richard Farley. Kartik is KKFLA737, Lawrence is LOZCAST, Lawscast, and Nipun is Nipun Chopra 7. Don't want to bother with Twitter? Go ahead and reach out via email, richard@worldsoccertalk.com.